When Miami plays in Dallas tonight, the Spanish-speaking fan base will be huge. Los Mavericks, EL Heat have two of the NBA's largest Spanish-speaking markets. Both teams have Spanish-speaking broadcasters to provide the play-by-play and dunk-by-dunk.
Mike Miller, el pase, Dwayne Wade pierde el balón, tiene que ir atrás, recupera, entrega Mike Miller, tiro de tres, no, y así va a terminar el encuentro. La victoria es el equipo de los Dallas Mavericks.
That's Victor Villalba, the official Spanish language voice of the Dallas Mavericks, calling Game 4. And Victor Villalba joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa.
And it sounds like you're getting a little excited there at the end of that game.
Yeah, well, that was the closing seconds of Game 4, a game that the Mavericks really needed to have to tie the series at 2. And, you know, the crowd was really into it, and it's just very difficult not to get a little loony there, especially when, you know, the Mavericks are pulling out that big win.
Do you find yourself mixing Spanish and English, sort of making some sort of Spanglish broadcast?
No, actually, no. There are regions in Texas where that Spanglish, as you mentioned, is more used. For example, in the in South Texas, in the Valley, you go there and people are just mixing both languages. But I really grew up using Spanish or English. And when I'm broadcasting, there are a few terms that are not necessarily translatable, but very few. And I really try to keep it just very clearly in Espanol.
Mm, and I guess there's a little bit of disagreement among Spanish language broadcasters over the right term to use, say, for, well, dunk for one, slam dunk.
Yes.
What do you say?
I say clavar. I use una clavada espectacular, for example, which basically is the term nail. You know, they basically nailed the ball. So it's la clavada espectacular. That's kind of how I go about it. But some of my colleagues will use donkear. Some of them will say volada or things like that. I heard that in Argentina they use a different term. But I use the word clavar.
What about what other words might be the source of some disagreement? Dribble, layup, what?
Well, dribleo. I use dribleo because there really is just no translation to the word dribble.
I love that. Could you say that again?
Dribleo.
Dribleo.
Dribleo, yes.
Wow.
Yes, cruza la media duela, el dribleo por el sector izquierdo, for example. And there you go, you know, using the word dribleo. And then also, you know, one that really is not translatable is alley-oop.
Ah.
When there's a pass under the bucket and the player will just slam it from there, that's basically alley-oop. And that's el pase, el alley-oop, y conecta, you know, there's really no translation to that.
Why mess with a good word?
Yes, exactly.
A good term.
Yes.
The teams in the finals, obviously the Heat and the Mavericks, both cities, Miami and Dallas, with huge Hispanic populations. Just one Latino player on the two teams, right? J.J. Barea for the Mavericks. Is he especially popular, do you think, among the Latino fan base?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, he goes back to Puerto Rico, and it's red carpet everywhere. I mean, he's dating Miss Universe 2006, I believe. And among fans here in Dallas, for example, yes, I mean, people recognize him. They're very proud of him. You know, when he goes to Miami, I mean, he has a lot of people to see. A lot of people are wanting to talk to him. I mean, his popularity with Spanish language fans is huge.
Are you thinking already, Victor, about tonight's game and what you'll say if the Mavericks win or if they lose, just how you're going to end your broadcast?
Your guess is as good as mine exactly what I'm going to say, but hopefully it's on the excited side because the Mavericks win.
I think it'll be excited no matter what. Victor Villalba, enjoy the game. I think you will.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Victor Villalba will be giving the Spanish play-by-play for the Dallas Mavericks tonight at Game 5 of the NBA Finals. Car sales in the U.S. have stalled. Right now, GM sells more cars in China than it does in America. Around the world, the American brands have a much higher cool factor. For example, GM's Buick is a hip car in China, and the U.S. car companies are looking to exploit that, as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
Let's talk about the future of the American car companies. I can sum that future up in a word: BRIC. Okay, actually, BRIC is an acronym.
The B for the Brazil, R for Russia, I for India, C for China. Did I say it okay, or did you want me to say it again?
Nah, I think we got it. BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Oh, and that's Michelle Krebs. She's a senior analyst with Edmunds.com, the automotive website. She's going to help walk us through this. So what's so important about Brazil, Russia, India, and China?
They are the fastest growing markets in the world.
They also have established manufacturing, and they're making money on commodities. That means they have cash. And
there's a young population that is coming into driving age, and there's a growing middle class in all of those countries that is making it possible to buy cars that never existed before.
Well, that potential has not been lost on the American carmakers. This week, they laid out their plans for the future. GM did it at its annual shareholders meeting in Detroit. I should say its first shareholders meeting since GM came out of bankruptcy. Here's Dan Akerson, the CEO of General Motors.
It really is the new GM. And we have a new attitude.
I just need to point out that every single time Dan Akerson gets up in front of an audience, he talks about the new GM. To be sure, the old GM was a dominant force globally, and the new GM is no slouch either. In the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, GM is the leader.
In the BRIC countries, between now and 2015, that volume will grow by 12 million units. That bodes well for us in the future.
Michelle Krebs, the analyst, says it's important to remember that the biases that many Americans have against GM and Ford don't carry over to other countries. When GM was losing consumer confidence and market share in the U.S., it was planting its flag overseas with, of all brands, Buick.
People just shook their head and said, that is just preposterous. It's a very harebrained idea. What are they doing? Looking back on that now, it was a stroke of genius because General Motors got in there early. They established a foothold, and they have grown and grown.
And they want to grow more. GM will be launching a new brand, much less fancy than Buick, one that's really, really basic, that's aimed at those young consumers who are pouring into the cities in China, buying their first car. Meanwhile, Ford won't be outdone. It says it wants to sell about 3 million more cars outside the U.S.
Kan een auto door de grill te openen en te sluiten de aerodynamica verbeteren?
That's one of Ford's global commercials. It's part of Ford's plan to streamline itself and gain economies of scale all over the globe. Ford just announced yesterday that it's starting a new partnership in Russia, where the company will get a plant near St. Petersburg. Gary Bradshaw is a portfolio manager with Hodges Capital Management in Dallas. He says the American companies may have been knocked down a few notches in the U.S., but in the rest of the world?
Just remember that the whole world is growing at a 5% GDP growth. Whether they're in India or China or Brazil or Pakistan or wherever you want to say, they want to live like me and you.
Bradshaw says, hopefully that means they want two cars in the garage. That, he says, is reason enough to bet on the U.S. car industry. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
More coming up from All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The United States and its allies are preparing for a post-Gaddafi Libya. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the Libyan leader's days are numbered. She met today with diplomats from more than 20 nations in Abu Dhabi to discuss an endgame in Libya and to boost support for the Libyan opposition. NPR's Michelle Kellerman was there.
The man who runs the Libyan rebel finances paced the halls anxiously as U.S., European, and Arab officials met in the vast and opulent Emirates Palace Hotel. They've been trying to figure out ways to funnel money to the Transitional National Council. And Ali Tarhouni says he's been hearing only promises of help for months.
Our people are dying. We're in a war. And it's been almost 4 months now. And nothing materialized so far.
It's beyond frustrating, Tarhouni said.
We are proud people, and I'm not begging. This is our money that we're asking for.
Diplomats acknowledge that there have been lots of legal problems getting some of the frozen Libyan assets to the rebels to help them run their government in Benghazi. Tarhouni says he'd like loans using frozen assets as collateral. The Transitional National Council promised in writing that any loans will be paid back by a future Libyan government. And the host of the meeting, Emirati Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed, said a new financial mechanism is finally up and running for some aid to start flowing.
What we've taken today in the UAE is a step forward. People could argue other ways that we haven't done enough, but I think time will show that we are doing the right thing at the right time.
Qatar and Kuwait promised to pitch in nearly $300 million, a mix of loans and gifts. Italy is also offering several hundred million dollars in loans to help the Transitional National Council, and Turkey said it would give $100 million. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the U.S. and other coalition partners are gaining more confidence in the rebel government, the TNC.
We have seen a great deal of improvement in the efforts of the TNC. We are obviously doing all we can to assist them in better organizing themselves and building those institutions that any state needs. But they know, and we know, there's a long road ahead.
They may not have much time. Clinton believes there's growing momentum against Muammar Gaddafi's regime. Australia's Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd said that was the general sense in the room at the conference in Abu Dhabi.
There have been multiple feelers from the Gaddafi regime to various members of the international community coming every other day. In our view, collectively, this represents growing desperation on the part of the regime, as we believe it enters its end period.
NATO has stepped up bombing raids in Tripoli, and Secretary Clinton says there's increasing military, financial, and diplomatic pressure on Gaddafi, with even Russia and China reaching out now to the rebels.
We have very good reason to believe that time is on our side, so long as we sustain the pressure.
Asked about exile options for Gaddafi, Clinton would only say there are numerous and continuing discussions, but no clear way forward yet. The so-called contact group will meet next in Istanbul in July. Libya was not the only issue on Clinton's agenda in Abu Dhabi. She also consulted Gulf countries about the conflict in Yemen. President Ali Abdullah Saleh was wounded in an explosion last week and is still getting medical treatment in Saudi Arabia. The U.S., along with other Gulf states, are trying, Clinton said, to promote a peaceful and orderly transition. She wouldn't comment on reports that the U.S. has stepped up drone attacks against a terrorist group based there. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Abu Dhabi.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The comments of a Toronto police officer have inspired thousands of women, but not in the way he intended. A few months ago, he told a university group that women would be safer from sexual attack if they avoided dressing a certain way. The young women not only took issue with his remarks, they founded a grassroots movement that is spreading across North America to challenge that attitude. We'll hear about this sartorial activism a little later in the program. But first, we return to one of the central achievements of the Obama administration that is still being fiercely opposed by those who consider it not an achievement, but an albatross to the American economy. We're talking about that hard-fought health care overhaul law. As we've been reporting, a number of states are waging fierce legal battles against various components of the law, which is called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. In Atlanta yesterday, Florida and 25 other states made their case to strike down the law before a three-judge federal appeals court panel. And at the heart of the opposition for many opponents is the so-called individual mandate, requiring that most Americans enroll in some form of health insurance by the year 2014. Whenever the eventual ruling by the Atlanta court, lawyers expect the matter will eventually end up before the U.S. Supreme Court, but we thought this was a good time to check in on the status of the legal challenges to the law and the substantive arguments behind them. We've called upon Caroline Fredrickson. She's the executive director of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, which describes itself as countering the activist conservative legal movement. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Also with us from the Cato Institute, that libertarian think tank, the director of health policy studies, Michael F. Cannon. He's been with us from time to time to talk about the health care law. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
So a tough day. It seems like it was a tough day for the Obama administration. And of course, we're always told you can't read too much into the questions that judges ask of lawyers. But right off the bat, the judges were saying that they knew of no case in American history where the courts had upheld the government's power to force someone to buy a product, and that product in this case being the health insurance law. So could you just talk a little bit about that? Is there analysis?
Well, it's
correct?
A very interesting kind of a question, because it sort of avoids the main issue here, which is that the Commerce Clause, which is the authority under which Congress passed the health care law, says nothing about activity or inactivity. The touchstone, really, as it has been under Supreme Court precedent for decades and decades, is that does this affect interstate commerce? And when you're talking about an industry that affects 17% of our economy. It clearly does affect commerce. It's clearly within the scope of the Commerce Clause. The real issue is, does Congress have the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate the healthcare industry, one of the biggest industries of our entire economy?
And you say it does.
Absolutely.
Michael, why don't we hear from you, and then I'll play a couple of clips from the argument itself. What's your response to that?
Well, the problem with that expansive view of the commerce power, and this is the part of the Constitution that says that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce among the states, is that it would give the government virtually unlimited control over the economy, unlimited power to force Americans to purchase any private product, and it's inconsistent with the entire structure, well, not only the language of the Commerce Clause, the plain language of the Commerce Clause, but the entire structure of the Constitution. And what basically happened here is we had a president, we had a Congress that was committed to forcing Americans to purchase insurance. If they had tried to do this by expanding Medicare to everyone, their courts would have upheld it. But they knew that they couldn't do that politically. The American people didn't want them to do that. They wouldn't be able to get the votes in Congress. So what they did was they forced Americans to purchase a private product, and they realized they had to come up with a constitutional justification for that. So they tried to shoehorn what they wanted to do, what they had already decided they were going to do, into this commerce power in the Constitution, which clearly does not give Congress the power that they're claiming.
Let me just play a clip from the arguments yesterday that, again, it was before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which was meeting in Atlanta. The three judges were apparently selected at random from the entire panel across the country. One newspaper described this as a clash of titans. And now we're going to hear former Solicitor General Paul Clement. He's representing the states. To your point, Michael, this is the point that he was making. Here it is.
It boils down to the question of whether or not the federal government can compel an individual to engage in commerce, the better to regulate the individual. They're not engaged in commerce. They're sitting in their living rooms. They're not doing anything.
Now, let's just play another clip from the other side. Here's Acting Solicitor General Neil Katchal. He's arguing that the individual mandate is constitutional because all Americans will eventually need health care, so therefore everybody should pay. Here it is.
Everyone is invariably consuming the good, and it's a question of who's going to pay for it. It's about the failure to pay, not the failure to buy.
One of the things that I think a lot of Americans have been puzzled by is this matter has already appeared before a number of lower courts, and they've split. Mm-hmm. So, Carolyn, why don't you help us understand why they've split?
Well, I mean, one hates to say it quite this way, but, you know, unfortunately, an obvious fact is that they've divided based on who the appointing presidents were. And so those judges who were appointed by Republicans have found the law unconstitutional, and those appointed by Democrats have found it constitutional. Now, obviously, I think there's more than just partisanship at issue here. I think there's actually ideological differences that undergird the different rulings. And one of the things I'd like to do, though, is step back for a second, because what I think is what really ironic here is that this proposal, the mandate, is really the free market proposal. And it was originally a Republican idea proposed in the early 90s as a counter to what people anticipated President Clinton's legislation to be, which would have been a single-payer universal program like an expansion of Medicare. And there was a group of Republican senators, including, I think, Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, including Jesse Helms and Trent Lott, not probably considered the most liberal members of the Senate, endorsed legislation that included an individual mandate. And even in 2005, you had Mitt Romney signing legislation in Massachusetts that included an individual mandate. This was always touted as the free market alternative to a single payer.
Mitt Romney being he's a Republican who's now running for president, who's the former governor of Massachusetts, who signed a similar law in Massachusetts. Michael, what about that?
Well, it's just nonsense to say that an individual mandate is a free market proposal when under an individual mandate, the government is compelling people to participate in the marketplace, to compelling people to purchase a product. That is not, by definition, that is not free. It's almost tautological. So it's really an odd point to make.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the challenges to the Obama administration's signature healthcare overhaul bill. And a number of states are challenging the law as unconstitutional. I'm joined by the Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies, Michael F. Cannon. He's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Caroline Fredrickson. She is the Executive Director of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. Should the impact of the law matter? And the impact of the law and its possible repeal matter, Michael, do you think? Or should this solely, in your view, be a philosophical argument? Judge Frank Hull repeatedly asked about the possible effect of the court striking down the individual mandate but upholding the rest of the law? And I'm asking your opinion about whether you think that should matter.
I think that the fact that the law has is already increasing people's health insurance premiums, that it is going to throw – will cause a third of employers to drop coverage according to a recent report. Those should not bear on the rulings that, on how judges weigh whether or not Congress has the power to force people to purchase health insurance or not. Those are immaterial to that question. What the judges should be looking at is, did the framers, when they drafted the Constitution and gave Congress certain enumerated powers, include the power to compel people to purchase a private product? Actually, they did, if what you're talking about is private arms. In order to arm the militia, Congress has, under the militia clause of the Constitution, compelled private citizens to purchase firearms in order to defend the country.
Caroline?
Well, it's very interesting that the one power that Congress has to affect commerce can't actually be used to engage in commerce. Under Supreme Court precedent of longstanding nature, Congress can pursue policies that are appropriate under the commerce power as long as the means that they choose are necessary and proper to the ends that are laid out. And the ends that are laid out in the legislation are clearly within Congress's power. They want to lower the cost of health insurance. They want to provide more health insurance for more people. They want to ensure that people with pre-existing conditions get covered. Those are all very legitimate ends. And I think it's the ironic moment here is that Michaels admits that Medicare is fully founded in the Constitution. So we can have a government-run universal program that Congress can pass, but you can't have a privately run system that Congress can help regulate.
I just want to clarify for those who may be wondering what we're talking about here. Michael cited a study by McKinsey & Company, the consulting firm. Republicans are circulating a study that predicts that up to 30% of companies will stop offering health insurance benefits, cut them, or reduce the number of employees who get them as a result of the law. And if, as you might imagine, there are counter studies that also say the effect is negligible and point to the number of Americans who will then be covered by health insurance who do not now have it. And I would like you to address in the minute we have left if what question is likely to go to the Supreme Court, since all sides predict that it will. I'm interested to know what question you think is the one that will be before the court eventually. And of course, I know you want to answer Caroline's
point.
Right.
I just want to clarify that I do not think that Congress was authorized to create Medicare by the Constitution. It is authorized under the Supreme Court's constitutional jurisprudence, which has strayed from the plain meaning of the Constitution. The Constitution, you know, includes the words general welfare, and that basically gives Congress the power to create any program at once that the Congress thinks promotes the general welfare. The problem with that interpretation of the Constitution is that if that's what the General Welfare Clause meant, then the other enumerated powers would be redundant. The framers wouldn't have had to put them in. So that's clearly not what the General Welfare Clause means, nor is the necessary and proper clause. It's not this open-ended grant of power to Congress to do whatever they want.
Well, this suggests to me again why the matter is before the courts, because you have two completely different interpretations of what this language is supposed to mean.
Right. So, but even if you work within the Supreme Court's constitutional jurisprudence, Obamacare goes too far. It claims a power for Congress that not even the Supreme Court has recognized that Congress has, and goes beyond what the Supreme Court has said that commerce power does encompass.
Okay. I don't know if I have time for another bite of that apple. Caroline?
Oh, just to say, I think where this goes ultimately is that these arguments do lead to a challenge to Medicare and Social Security. And I think that's the real debate we're having here.
Okay. Michael, what do you think the real debate is that we're having here?
The debate we're having right now is about the commerce power. The other debate about Medicare and Social Security has to do with a different part of the Constitution. This question is, does the commerce power give Congress the authority to force people to purchase a private product? And if the courts strike this law down, it will have zero effect on Medicare and Social Security.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Michael F. Cannon is the Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies. The Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank. Caroline Fredrickson is the Executive Director of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, which describes itself as countering the activist conservative legal movement. They were both here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios for a spirited discussion, but civil, and we appreciate that. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.